Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. Now, you've made a good decision to download this as you have 40 minutes of massive football debate to follow, including Arsenal's humiliation at Old Trafford, Chelsea's win over plucky Norwich. God, that sounds patronizing, doesn't it? And footballing philanthropy. What on earth is Samuel Eto'o doing? With me to discuss all this, it's Ben Smith, it's Alison Rod, and of course, from lovely Rippenden, it's Mr. Ollie Kay. So, how about we begin? I imagine you all expect me to start at Old Trafford with United's historic 8-2 win over Arsenal, and that's exactly what we'll do. But Ollie, I want to start with you, and what I would like to do is, before we inevitably begin our inquest on Arsenal, I want to talk a little bit about Manchester United, because I thought they were actually extremely impressive, and I thought they were actually probably more impressive than they were in the two previous matches. And it's still this sort of Manchester United alternative lineup with all the kids in.
Yeah, I mean, there was that amazing stat yesterday about there being only two survivors from the Champions League final starting lineup, which is only 3 months earlier, Rooney and Evra. And you look at this team, and I think, had people been looking at it 2 weeks ago, going into the season, they would have said, God, that is a weakened United team with no Ferdinand, no Vidic, no Carrick, no Fletcher, etc., no Raphael, no Fabio. And it just looked, I mean, they were just fantastic. They've been fantastic in the last two games. I think they've possibly been slightly fortunate to face two teams who are in a pretty bad state at the moment themselves, Arsenal and Spurs, but they were absolutely brilliant. You look at not only at Rooney and Young, who I think will both claim most of the headlines, but along with Arsenal, but look at Cleverley, who was brilliant, barely gave the ball away in midfield, always looking forward, always progressive. And the one that really impressed me yesterday was Chris Smalling, absolute revelation. Yeah. At right back.
Right, I'm totally with you on Smalling, and I think, and Young as well. I mean, I'm not a big Ashley Young guy, but I got to take my hat off. He was fantastic. Alison, I want to ask you about Wayne Rooney and his free kicks, because I think it was actually, these were the third and fourth free kicks of his career that he scored. But I looked at how well he struck those. I looked at that other chance he had, the one which obviously wasn't a free kick, but the one where he hit the post, which I thought was just brilliant, confident, well executed. And I'm wondering, is this the same guy as 12 months ago, right? What's different?
Well, he's become a senior player. He's not the embarrassment anymore. He's not the raw talent who we won't let him speak because he's just comes over as a bit thick. He's someone who's grown into his job, if you like, I think. And I think when he's interviewed now, I find that part of him unrecognisable as well. He's sort of thoughtful and modest, and I was watching those free kicks and thinking, what what would another team have done against them? Probably the goalkeeper's positioning wasn't great, but that's always with hindsight that the goalkeeper's, you know, a yard the wrong side of the wall. They were phenomenal, and he's probably, of anyone in this country, on top of his game right now.
Ben, are you going to be the one who makes a joke that he's more confident because of his hair?
I don't think I'm in a position to do that.
That's not a very nice thing to say. No, but he looks
like a different player. I think a lot of things are more settled in his life. I think you look back 12 months, we were about to see revelations appear in the Sunday newspapers about his private life. He clearly wasn't settled at United. There were problems that would bubble up in October. Now he looks like a very happy chappy, and his football is bearing that out, really. He was fantastic yesterday.
Ollie, in England, of course, are playing this week. Thinking back, a Rooney with a Rooney like this and the same cast of characters, do England have a shot at winning the World Cup or the Euros?
I think that would still be quite a lot, quite a leap. I mean, England are in a transitional stage, and I don't think they're anything like as well equipped as a sort of collective force to go through a transitional period anything like as well as a club like Man United does. I mean, United's ability to evolve and you know, revolve, to use the famous Alan Partridge expression, is unrivaled. England are famously bad at transition, but they will certainly have a better shot at it if Rooney is in this form, and even if Ashley Young is in this form, he does suddenly look like a top class player.
I mean, that is the route to England winning something, isn't it, Ollie? That England build round a team that exists already in the Premier League and are doing well.
Listening to people's argument previously, and you look through history, you look at the team built around the sort of Man United core of the late 90s, and that didn't really work at international level. A lot of players like Burton and Gary Neville and Phil Neville were accused of not being international class, being great club players. It was a very similar thing happened with Liverpool in the late 70s, early 80s, where they were the core of a team that didn't really work at international level. So I think there's always a big difference. I think it's harder to play at international level. It's harder to play for England, at least, even not because of the standard, but just because it just seems like a slightly broken machine sometimes.
Might have worked better, of course, if Roy Keane, Ryan Giggs and Dwight York had been English. Mm-hmm. And maybe Peter Schmeichel too, for that matter. But I want to wrap up United with one point on David De Gea, who was criticized a lot in the first 2 weeks. Now, he made a mistake, I think, again, quite an obvious one. However, to me, this is a slightly different mistake. It's a different type of error. To me, it looked like he wanted to make a kick save. I don't know if his foot got stuck in the ground or something. I don't think it was lack of coordination. And the ball went through his legs. To me, that's less worrying than somebody who, you know, misjudges a ball or seems to fall asleep. Ben, you're nodding. Are you just being polite?
No, absolutely. I think the feeling earlier in the season was that these were technical errors that were, you know, there were worrying errors in his technical ability to get down quick enough to make a save to his left or to his right when a ball's coming at him from outside the area. But as you say, yesterday just looked like one of those things that could happen to any goalkeeper. I think everything else going on around him must be giving him confidence. And certainly if he is making errors at the moment, the rest of the team are making sure they're not being shown up, which is great for him.
Well, if you say that penalty, of course, he was mobbed by his teammates. Yeah. Ollie, you on board in that? De Gea, not a problem, not an issue, nothing to see here?
Yeah, it might be a short-term problem just because he is still getting used to it, but I don't see him being a long-term problem or even a medium-term problem at all. He's one of the best goalkeepers in Europe. He might not be one of the top three goalkeepers in Spain, but he's better than 90% of the keepers in the Premier League.
Okay, now, moving on to Arsenal, you got to go back. It wasn't not this century, not the past century. It's the one before that, the last time that Arsenal gave up 8 goals in a league game.
Now, didn't you love that, Gab, when that statistic came out on Sky Sports straight after the game? It was delivered so deadpan. I laughed out loud. It was 1896, the last time that Arsenal conceded 8 goals in a league game. I mean, that's a phenomenal statistic.
I'm surprised
statistic.
They even mentioned it on Sky, because, of course, there was no Premier League back then, so it didn't actually happen, right? But I want to chuck this out, and I want you guys to convince me. I am playing devil's advocate to some degree, but you look at this Arsenal lineup and, you know, you've got some guy named Jenkinson, who I'm assuming there's a reason why, you know, he only cost £1 million and was playing his 14th game ever and came from Charlton. You have Giroud, who even when he's fit doesn't really look fit to me. You have Armand Traore, who is basically permanently injured and was at Juventus last year and was awful. And I think Arsenal had to take him back because he's under contract, kind of like the way you take in a stray cat. You had somebody named Coughlin, who seemed like a punchline until very recently. You have Rosicki, who I don't think has been good for 3-4 years. You have Ramsey, who is good but is a reserve, let's not forget. You have Arshavin, who looks like he'd rather be at the hairdresser than be on the pitch. You have Walcott with all his limitations. And of the two starting central defenders, the one who was there wasn't the good one, Vermaelen, because he's injured. It's Koscielny. It's the one nobody likes. So if I'm Wenger, can I make a case and say, yeah, okay, it's, you know, sucks that we lost this game, but it's not Arsenal who lost the game. It's Arsenal's second team or maybe even third team.
Yeah, but okay, that's the very point. That's the very point, though, isn't it? I would agree with your assessment, even though you're pushing it, on each one of those players. I would say Arshavin was an embarrassment, actually. And he did not deserve to even be picked for that game when they're short of players.
He tried to get himself sent off, to be fair. That was good.
He was a pretty atrocious, I thought. But there was a lot that was wrong with each individual player, either not necessarily their fault, but they're not ready to be playing at this level. So if you have to go to Old Trafford with that at your disposal, why do you pretend that they're all world beaters? That's how they lined up, and that's how they tried to play. There were spasms of that match where Arsenal did play quite nicely. They were moving up the field with real flow, and they looked like they might just score. You can't play the entire 90 minutes with that lineup, with that mentality. You're going to get absolutely stuffed.
But
and that's
not,
what happened.
But it's not in Wenger's DNA. You're just saying, you know.
Yeah, well, that's rubbish, Ben. Because there's no such thing as football
but,
DNA.
But there's no way he was.
You're
ever
a manager, and you manage what you have.
Well, exactly. That's the problem. I don't think he is. He was never going to go, right, we're going to shut up shop and try and get away with a 2-3-0 defeat here. I don't think he was ever thinking that. Even when they went 3-1 down, they had a go. They thought, let's see if we can get one or two more and you know, get back in this. They didn't think, let's prevent an embarrassment. The whole thing is a mess, and I think in many ways, although Wenger does need to, is the man to turn it around, I believe he still should be given the chance to do that. I think a lot of the failings are because of things he has done or hasn't done, actually, as the summer has gone on.
Ollie, sorry, is the glass really not half full when this collection of waifs and strays and freaks goes to, I'm not knocking them, but I mean, this is not Arsenal's first team, right? Even without Nasri and Cesc, even without the new signings are coming in, he is missing sort of six or seven, I think there were maybe four starters. You could argue that they can go to Old Trafford, they can score two goals and miss a penalty against the best team in England. Yes, I mean, is that a positive you can take from this?
No, there is no positive about yesterday. I mean, there's been, apart from getting through to the Champions League group stages, which I think was an achievement under the circumstances, I think there's no positive about what's happened at Arsenal this month. It's been really bad. The injuries and suspensions are a real problem because the squad is weak enough as it is. And, you know, we could all name the players who were missing yesterday, Vermaelen, Gibbs, Song, Wilshere, Frimpong, etc. But
Sanya, Gervinho.
Well, yeah, but you look at the number of players that were missing or that weren't in United's starting lineup yesterday.
Hey, that's right. Not only anybody's arguing that Arsenal and United are on the same level. I mean, is it really fair to compare Arsenal to United?
It was last season when they were going for the title in February. I mean, I think it ended the way pretty much everybody expected it to end. But the idea that the injury problems alone are the cause of this, I mean, they've made a bad situation worse. But there are as notable absentees from the United team yesterday as from the Arsenal team, and that just tells you that the squad, which lacked backbone and lacked strength and lacked depth last season, has lost what was masquerading as its backbone. There's no depth to that squad at all.
Okay, so What does he do? I mean, I watched a little bit afterwards, and I listened to Paul Merson say, "You need to spend money. You need to spend money," you know, and you know, big English center half Cahill, Jagielka. Though I mean, watch Cahill this weekend. I don't know if that's any indication. I don't know if this is exactly. I don't know if he'd be part of the problem rather than part of the solution. I mean, Ollie, what do you do? What do you think he will do? I mean, there's the transfer window shuts on Wednesday.
Well, he's famous for his sort of resistance to the transfer market and this idea that the transfer market is the cure to all ills in football. And I think he's, in some ways, his attitude has been very healthy, but he needs to be pragmatic this time. He needs to look at the weaknesses in the team. He said, you know, he said they're going to sign a striker, Park from Monaco. He also talked of signing a defender and a midfielder, but that doesn't sound like enough to me. That doesn't sound like enough, even with the injured players or suspended players to come back. It doesn't sound like enough to take them to where they should be or to where they were last season. I think they, I mean, I keep hearing about a centre back. I think they need a left back because I don't think Gibbs is good enough, even when he's fit, which is rare. I think they need they don't need bodies, but they need minds. They need people who are leaders who have got experience, who can help these kids through what is going to be a very difficult season. And if it means Frimpong plays 15 games rather than 30 games in his first season, then so be it.
I'd ask you guys about Park Chu-young, but I'm assuming I've probably seen more of him than...
Undoubtedly you have, okay.
Unless, does anybody have a strong opinions on him? Okay. No, then the type of player he is he's a guy who had a very bad injury a few years ago. I don't think he's back to the level he was at, but he's sort of a striker, second forward type, but he's very prolific. He's fast, and he's very good at free kicks. I think off the bench, he can certainly help Arsenal. I think he's also a bargain because obviously Monaco were relegated. Does that sound like the profile that the other guy they need, Ben?
No, I agree that, you know, you're saying, Merson's saying, let's just spend. And I agree to some extent that is not the solution. You can't just say, right, we'll get a big English centre half in, we'll get this guy in, and we'll get that guy in. Well, here's 35 million quid. Let's hope that pulls together a team, because that's never has been Wenger's way and never will be, I think. He obviously,
so then maybe do you change Wenger then?
Well, I think Wenger has to change himself. He has to look at it and realise that perhaps what he has been doing for the past 5 years hasn't worked. And he does have to accept that he has made mistakes, and perhaps, you know, things that the time is to change. The time to change is now, but he's got 2 days to do it. This is the problem for him. He's going to have to make a lot of big decisions in a very short period of time when there's a huge amount of pressure on him. And that is never a good environment in which to you know, rebuild a squad, I don't think.
From the crucifixion of Arsenal on to Stamford Bridge and Chelsea and Norwich. And, you know, I thought Chelsea, again, you know, in the end, you say that you watch the 3-1 scoreline, you see the goals, and you're like, oh, look, you know, Villas-Boas is sorting them out. Like, no, Chelsea were absolutely dreadful in the first half, and Norwich were very, very good. Norwich have this player, Houlihan, who looks like he's about, you know, and I'm sorry, I know he's familiar to all the people who watch the Championship, blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, I don't, so he was rather unfamiliar to me until this season. This guy is about 3 feet tall. It looks like his kit is too big for him. He sits between the midfield and Holt up front, and basically what he does is he sits there and he confuses John Obi Mikel, and it's extremely, extremely effective, and he's got a bit of quality as well. And I thought, you know, Lambert completely outthought and out-tacticked Villas-Boas for most of the game, actually.
That's not true, Gab. I was there as well. And Lambert tried to outwit Villas-Boas. Oh, I can't get me shes and s's wrong there. But he tried to, and he played three central defenders. And they didn't know what they were doing. They're not used to playing three at the back. And it was a mess. It was only when they went 4-4-2 through injury, as opposed to him, Lambert, accepting it was going wrong. He said that. I mean, he may have accepted it was going wrong, that they started to look better. I mean, Houlihan, I agree, was a breath of fresh air, a revelation, and looked better than Modric did yesterday. If Chelsea are thinking about someone who can play play and do darty things in the middle. But I don't think Lambert got it quite right. And maybe if they started badly, Norwich, because their defence weren't sure where they should be.
Okay, but they have a defence of people who look like they walked in off the street. So, you know, to some degree, and they're taking on Chelsea away from home. I think they actually did well to just concede the one goal. And, you know, if Grant Holt, you know, and I appreciate it's not easy being that size and being asked to be all coordinated, but that ball where he sprung the offside trap and he tried to sort of turn and try to knock it past Hilario while doing it at the same time and whiffed completely, which I admit was difficult for somebody like him. If that goes in, we have a different game.
No, I'm agreeing with you. In a way, they did better than you're saying, because I think their lineup was bad, and to actually get to the point where we're all saying didn't Norwich play well when they started with the wrong tactics means they did extremely well. They overcame two hurdles: playing away at Stamford Bridge and not setting up properly.
Ollie, he played Drogba and Torres, which was something that I think, you know, works in sort of Panini sticker land. I mean, Ancelotti wasn't able to make it work last year. That's why he stopped doing it and lost his job. Villas-Boas hasn't done it yet. We saw this for the first time. To me, it looked like the two guys just get into each other's way. And later in the second half, when Torres supposedly played wider, he didn't actually play wider. He just kept coming inside. Is this a non-starter playing those two people together?
I think it looks like a non-starter. I mean, they worked on it extensively in training for about 3 weeks when Torres first arrived in January, and you looked at it in the games, and it was calamitous, really. I mean, those two are both better off as the main focal point of an attack. They've never really. I mean, people will, I'm sure, dredge something up from the odd game in Euro 2008 with David Villa, but they've never. Torres has never been more comfortable than when he's up on his own, Drogba likewise. And for two guys who seemingly have no chemistry to be asked to forge a partnership again, I mean, it looks desperate. And I think Chelsea've got a real problem there. I was fairly cynical, sceptical about the Torres move when it happened, it's gone even worse than I imagined. It won goal in 21 appearances now, 14 starts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Obviously, there will be a game soon where Torres will score goals, and he'll probably score 3 in a month or something like that, but it just isn't working.
3!
My point is, he's not working, and I'm sure he'll score a couple of goals sooner or later, and people will say, oh, look, Torres is back to his best. Torres has not played consistently well for getting on for 2 years. And if I was a Chelsea fan, or if I was the guy who had written a £50 million cheque there, I would be very concerned.
But there were signs in the first game of the season that he looked like he might be approaching something of the old Torres. I mean,
physically, I think he's there.
Yeah, yeah. I just wonder though if it's something to do with knowing he's their main man, and I think he's a player who likes to be loved in simple terms, and I think at the moment he doesn't know whether he can call himself Chelsea's main man. With Drogba there, who has given, you know, Villas-Boas every reason to think he should play, I just wonder whether Torres will ever thrive with Drogba still in, you know, on the fringes of the side. I'm not sure there's room for both of them.
I'm with you. That's why I think they should have moved Drogba and probably Anelka as well in the summer. Alistair, I want to ask you, Villas-Boas came in saying like, you know, don't compare me to Mourinho and stuff. And many of us, I mean, doing our research, having met the guy, say, no, he's not like Mourinho. He's not prickly and spikely and spiky when he doesn't get his way. But I wasn't at the post-match press conference, but I did see on television, he did throw a little bit of a little catty hissy fit.
Yeah, he was didn't a little over sarcastic.
What I saw on Match of the Day was, Lambert had said that it shouldn't have been sending off. I think it was the goalkeeper Ruddy on Ramirez. And do you want to tell us what Villas-Boas said?
He has a very good imagination, doesn't he? He's what he accused Lambert of. He did say it with quite deep sarcasm in his voice. But they'd clashed on the touchline, the two camps.
Villas-Boas and Lambert?
Well, not Villas-Boas, particularly his fitness coach. He'd got
Robbie
a bit over.
D.
He got a bit overexcited when. He indicated that the goalkeeper should be sent off, and that if anything gets another team upset, it's when someone from the other bench is saying this player should be sent off, and it's none of their business, and they shouldn't do it. Everyone knows they shouldn't do it, but everyone gets very excited, and so Lambert was a bit brusque and unpleasant about the sort of the etiquette of the Chelsea camp, and I think once that filtered through to Villas-Boas, he decided he'd give as good as he got, and so, well, he doesn't know much because he can't see a clear penalty when there's one straight in front of him. So that's what it was. It was just a bit of a there was tension on the touchline, which is indicative of something, isn't it? Because you wouldn't expect the Chelsea camp to feel any sort of threat from the visit of Norwich, and they did get the team did get under Chelsea's skin. So I think, although it's quite nice when a manager shows an element of personality, I think it also proves that Villas-Boas is struggling to feel that Chelsea have that sort of aura about them under his tutelage at the moment.
Ollie, one of the positives though is that Juan Mata and Romelu Lukaku came on, and both looked really, really good. I'm assuming Mata will get a fair amount of playing time. Lukaku, I'm not so sure. Although I suppose he's young enough, maybe you can try to make him the world's biggest, heaviest, quickest winger. What do you make of those two? And could the fact that, you know, the likes of Anelka, again, Malouda, Drogba, Sturridge, they have so many bodies there, could that stand in the way of their development?
It might well do. The players themselves, Mata, Lukaku, and indeed Sturridge, they're all really good young players, and they need to get enough football this season. I mean, I'm sure Mata in particular will, but I don't know whether there is a clear vision and sort of strategy at Chelsea as to what their lineup is going to be, what the long term plan is. With, you know, I'm surprised that Anelka is still at the club, that Drogba is still at the club. I mean, it just all seems too congested, and I think they need to shed one of the older players, maybe Drogba or Anelka, or maybe send Lukaku or Sturridge out on loan, because at the moment it looks too congested.
I'm actually with you on that. Final word on Norwich. Again, I was impressed not just by Lambert's job, but also some of these players they have are very good. And again, people are going to be like, oh, Gab, you're a snob. You don't watch the championship. No, I don't really watch much of the championship. I only watch a little bit on TV because that's not what my job is. But this guy Morrison, who came on, he's kind of like an athletic freak, isn't he? I mean, Am I the only one who was just impressed with sort of this big bald dude who runs like a maniac who makes Ivanovic look like a pile of dew?
No, I think that. I think I think Morrison was impressed.
Logically, is he a potential long-term partner for Holt? I mean, could you have two strikers like that?
I think it's not been done before, but there's no reason to think that Norwich couldn't do it. I think they had players all across the pitch who were slightly surprising, certainly to me as well. And I think, given what we've seen already, there's reason to think they may actually put up a real fight this year and perhaps defy the odds. I don't know if you would agree with that, Alison.
Well, they do amuse me a bit, because when they came out, I mean, yeah, there were a lot of people in the press box who hadn't seen Norwich before, and there were a lot of my colleagues going, oh, a lot of units out there, aren't there? I mean, there were these fridges just wandering around the pitch, and they look very Championship. I mean, they were in League One 2 years ago. They have that look about them, and yet they don't play stodgily at all. They have pace where it matters on the flanks, and good spirit.
All right. Samuel Eto'o, by my reckoning, and I know this is a slightly theoretical argument and it can confuse some people, including the company that doesn't seem to understand the difference between net and gross wages, but you can read my blog to find more about that. But if Samuel Eto'o were in England, and if he was earning the same amount of money after tax that he's earning in Angie, he would be the most expensive, he would be the highest paid athlete in the world in any kind of team sport, possibly in F1 or golf as well. I can't quite figure out, although I imagine Tiger probably still makes more despite everything. It's pretty remarkable. You all know the story. 30 years old, and he turns his back on the Champions League and moves to a place where there is no Champions League football. Moves to a 20,000 seat stadium in Dagestan, which right now is the second most dangerous part of Russia. He doesn't actually move to Dagestan, because he will live in Moscow with the rest of his team and simply fly down for games, which is what Anji do for security reasons. I'm not going to ask you about whether Anji can challenge for the Russian title, get the Champions League, or so on. I'm just kind of fascinated in the thought process. Can anybody relate to this? Anybody want to come out and make the case, say, like, yes, it makes sense when, you know, you've been earning something like when you've been earning about £8 million a year after tax to go and bump it up to £17.5 million after tax, as he's done now.
So is your question, why does someone who's already very wealthy need to be ultra wealthy?
Exactly, and whose career is winding down. Why give up on the chance? I mean, he's never going to be 30 years old again. He's never going to have a chance to compete at the peak of his powers in the Champions League.
Maybe he was always motivated by the money and not by the glory. Who's to say? And they've done studies to show that there's a high proportion of people who, if you give them sudden wealth, and for most footballers it is sudden, after 6 months, whatever money you have, it feels like not enough, and you get very angry and more upset than someone who has nothing. You feel you deserve more. So he's probably in that category of person who has enjoyed the money more than any other element of the game. And if that's what it is, then he's going to say, yes, please, I'll play anywhere.
Ollie, you have a degree in behavioural psychology. What do you think?
Well, we all know that an English player would never do that. That an English player at the age of 30, 31 would never turn his back on the big clubs of Europe and go and, you know, play in a backwater, apart from David Beckham, of course.
It was a joke. Everybody laughed politely.
And Robbie Keane.
It's comparable in some ways to the Beckham thing. There's obviously a big difference between going to play for Angie and going to play for LA Galaxy, but it seems like putting. I know there's the Beckham sort of spiel about the project and how exciting it is. I mean, Beckham made a poor career decision that seemed to be more about the Beckham brand, and I don't know whether to what extent money is the issue there, but he certainly didn't do his football career any good.
Ollie, though, on Beckham, I mean, despite the fact that everybody reported that stupid $250 million number and whatever, the reality with Beckham is that he probably didn't even benefit financially from moving to LA. you know, because he just was never able to exploit it to the degree that it was what he could have made had he stayed in Europe.
But
it was probably more about the stardom and the celebrity and in a new market,
that's
in a
exactly
new world.
That's exactly what it's about. I mean, I don't think you can compare Beckham with Eto in this case, because Beckham was moving to Hollywood. You know, he was moving for fame. He was moving for his wife and his kids. He was moving for the benefit of the brand, as you said, Ollie. Eto is moving to a place where he's having to be flown into Dagestan, as Gab says, one of the most dangerous places in Russia. You can't see anything other than pound signs or, you know, in his eyes. This is a decision that is purely motivated by greed, is the only word that comes to mind, I think.
But I'm saying that it's the similarity is that it's a decision that is not based on footballing ambition.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that's a great point, and I think Ollie nailed it there. It's not based on footballing ambition. I think clearly, I mean, best case scenario, he will see Champions League football in 18 months' time, and with a team that, you know, who knows if they'll even be able to compete. But what I find interesting is that it is a non-footballing thing, and you could argue that in the same way that David Beckham was much more, or is much more, than just a footballer, in the sense that he has this whole sort of celebrity dimension and whatever else. A lot of people making the case that Samuel Eto'o is much more than just a footballer as well. He's won everything there is to win, realistically, at club level. He's thinking about what he's going to do after his career. The fact of the matter is, in 3 years' time, he's going to have an extra £50 million cash-free in the bank. And I know it's easy to lose track of how much footballers make, but it's probably more money than he's made in his entire career. So he will be an extremely rich man. He's from Cameroon. He's very attached to not just Cameroon, but the neighboring countries like Gabon and whatnot. He will probably, if he moves back there, probably instantly become, you know, one of the three or four richest people in that part of the world. He has ambitions for a political career. He has ambitions for his foundations. He wants to do good. Is this at the heart of it? And if that's the case, should we be faulting him? I mean, if somebody's going to go out and spend £50 million, I'd rather it was Samuel Eto'o spending them in West Africa than Suleiman Karamov.
What evidence do we have that he's going to reinvest the money in countries that desperately need it? I mean, I'm always being told by advertising £10 a month will put a child through college in some very poor part of the world.
Well, I mean, he hasn't come out and said this. I'm only here to take the money, can I go and spend it in Cameroon afterwards? But he is one of the most philanthropically active footballers in the world. He has at least two foundations that are involved in everything from hospitals to scholarships to empowering women and various minorities in Cameroon and in Gabon. And he's also not just somebody who signs checks. He actually personally goes and fundraises as well, which you know, I think sets him apart.
Let's take it all back. He's sacrificing the glory and the beautiful element of his career because he knows he can do more for the people at large if he goes with the Russian bucks.
I mean, if that all does turn out to be the case, then as Alison says, we'll have to hold our hands up and say, you know, Samuel, I'm sorry I called you greedy. You were doing it all for the greater good. And you know, if he does do that, then you kind of think, fair enough. Well, what a great thing to do. If he has won everything in the game and he is happy with his career and he's made his peace with that, then going and earn a few bucks and spending it for...
It couldn't be more logical, really. No. It's a career step.
Take it all back.
Ollie, are we near the stage where footballers become so big and so wealthy that, you know, and so famous and culturally significant that they can just go and, after they retire, realistically embark, say, in a career in politics? I mean, George Weah obviously, you know, attempted it as well, and maybe there's a bit of a parallel there.
I think it's probably easier in Africa, where these guys are very much the sort of iconic figures of their country. I mean, you could say, well, Beckham or Zidane or whoever is an iconic figure in their own country, but it is a very different. It is a very different establishment.
You don't see Jamie Carragher perhaps one day running for mayor of Liverpool?
Mayor of Sefton, I think.
Mayor of Sefton, yeah.
It's quite possibly. He's already a freedom.
For one of those Marxist parties that Tony Evans likes?
But the, I mean, just going back slightly, There was a quote that Ian Hawkey in the Sunday Times piece about Eto'o the other day, and he produced an old quote from Eto'o from 8 years ago when he signed for Barcelona. He said, "I will run like a black man so I can live like a white." And that sounded like a guy who was aspiring to earn as much as he could in his career, to improve his lifestyle, improve probably the lifestyle or the wealth that he could enjoy post retirement. And obviously, it sounds, from what you're saying, like he wants to do, he wants to do it so more people can enjoy the offshoots of his wealth.
I mean, his other famous quote when he was at Barcelona was that, like, it was, "I live in Barcelona. At night when I go to bed, I sleep in Africa." Mm. So he is obviously somebody who has maintained this sort of very active tie and active interest with his country. And I don't know. I guess for me, I mean, we can't read people's minds, but I feel slightly more confident about his reasons for going there. And while I find it slightly depressing, then, and it's not just him, I mean, Roberto Carlos is there as well, and guy like Diego Tardelli, the Brazilian who could be playing in a top European league easily and making a lot of money, but perhaps not obscene money like he's making now, that these people have chosen to go there. And what is clearly not about developing football in Russia, because if you're doing football in Russia, you go where there's actually people and fans, and not an artificial team that was started a decade ago and is in this sort of freakish situation with flying in and whatnot. They're actually only 200 miles from Tehran. Maybe one day they'll choose to live there and fly away. I don't know. I am blown away. But I guess time will tell on Samuel Eto'o. But I think the one thing we all need to bear in mind, and I may be in the minority here, is that even if he did just do it for money, it doesn't erase the incredible sort of 12 years, incredible career he's had, the number of people he's proven wrong over the years. And the fact that I think we did witness probably between 2000 and 2010, he's certainly one of the top two or three players in his position in the world. Okay, time now for some quick hits. Allison, you get to go first. Liverpool pummel Bolton 3-1, and this time it's Carroll who's on the bench to start. Is this a one-off, or might we be seeing the quicker, peppier Liverpool more often?
I think Liverpool is so good. We can write off the $35 million we spent on Carroll. I wasn't that convinced by his signing. I couldn't work out where he'd fit in. And Liverpool have been playing some really good, sparky 1-2s, almost as good as Man City. So I don't think it's a one-off. I think we'll see the quicker, peppier Liverpool more often. Yes.
Noisy neighbours may have been overshadowed by Manchester United, but Ollie winning 5-1 at White Hart Lane is still a big deal. Is this Manchester City's best performance under Mancini? And if they play this well the rest of the season, do they win the title?
I think I would probably be splitting hairs if I mentioned a brilliant performance at Fulham last season. I mean, this... Yesterday was in some ways the best performance because it was against a Tottenham, albeit a sort of depleted, demoralised Tottenham. It was a brilliant performance. You can only beat what's there, but they did it brilliantly. Dzeko looked superb, 4 goals, superb performance. And if they do play like that every week, if they win 5-1 every week, then I dare say they will win the title because they'll have a 100% record.
He's always been good in mass at Ollie Kay. Speaking of Spurs, Harry Redknapp explained to the media that Modric didn't want to play, but he told him he had to play, and when he did play, he was frankly rubbish. Ben, what do you make of this, and do you think you'll be moving a few postcodes southwest?
It's going to be on a joke, this situation now, unfortunately, for Spurs. I think they do have to hold their hands up and say they've done their best to try and hang on, but now they need to do a deal with Chelsea and get rid of him, get someone else in. There is no point in keeping a player who wants to be somewhere else. If they do hang on to him in the next few days, you're going to have a player who isn't himself for the rest of the season. So, yes, sell him now.
Bye-bye, Luca.
Gab, a question for you. Real Madrid began their Liga campaign last night at Zaragoza. How did they get on?
They got on rather well. They won 6-0. Even Kaká came off the bench and scored and also set one up. Cristiano Ronaldo got a hat-trick. All more the same. The one thing is Zaragoza, absolutely a terrible side. They're in deep financial doo-doo. They basically sold anybody they could sell in the summer. So it's not really a benchmark. But, as the wise man says, you can only beat what's in front of you. And Ronaldo is on pace to score 114 goals in La Liga this season.
Ooh.
Delighted you could join us this week. Remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all your news, your gossip, your analysis. You can do the web chats. Patty's on Monday, I'm on Tuesday, Ollie's on Wednesday. You can get Graham Spears and Matt Dickinson later in the week as well. And remember, of course, you can also always follow us on Twitter. Till next week, bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.